The American people Britain changed our titles then, and our chairperson today is Senator Pascal Mooney, who is in forced retirement and exile from the Dáil of Shannon at the moment. But Pascal, anybody who knows the Emirates and more knows Pascal's commitment to the Emirates, people are delighted to see him in the room, say thanks to him for the work he's done over the years, and it's great to have him on board for us this afternoon.
He will be, maybe tell you himself about, he is committing to a number of radio programmes to deal with immigrant issues. So to have a knowledge of what's going on in this room and to have the ear of people going on in this room will be helpful in the way forward for him. I know we're running a little late, but that's very one of the characteristics of Irish immigrant organisations. So those who travel a bit of jet lag, but I know Pascal will help keep the timetable in order now. We may have to go a little bit beyond the time we said, but we'll do that by negotiation. So, Pascal, I hand over to you to keep us going on this afternoon's part of the timetable. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much indeed, Father Alan. Can I say that I was very honoured to have been asked by EAN to host this afternoon, and it's nice to meet some familiar faces as well, both from home and abroad. Just to very briefly touch on what Father Alan said, for the last number of years, RTE Radio have commissioned four programmes for transmission during the month of December, which focuses on the Irish experience in various British cities. The type of the programme mightn't be the most exciting of all. It's called The Irish Experience. Essentially, what we've been trying to do is to reflect the Irish experience in the various cities that we've visited, where there are structured Irish centres. And as you know, the Irish government, somewhat belatedly but very welcome, have upped the ante in terms of financial contributions to the Irish abroad. It's now, I think, standing at something around 15 million a year, of which about 80% goes to the UK. And you can see it on the ground. And on the other 20, most of that will go to the US. Sheila Gleeson would know, but some go to the other, diaspora are gathered. But essentially what we wanted to do, because all this money was being spent, and because it's taxpayers' money, and because of the fact that it had led to, in a sense, a renaissance, even at a time when there is an ageing population in the UK among the Irish, and a renaissance on the cultural and sporting side because of the money and the capacity building that has been generated as a result, we wanted to try and reflect that. So the new series started last night. It goes out on Friday nights at 9 o'clock from now until December. We pre-record them, of course. Last night in Luton. Next week it's from the Irish Centre in Camden Town. And the next week I'm going to England to record the third programme in St Michael's Centre in Liverpool, and the last one will be done, rather interestingly, in Prestatyn in North Wales, where there is an Irish community, and we'll be talking to them as well. Following on that, I have been asking RTE, and I know you want to listen to the people, I know it's just when Father Alan mentioned it, he said that it might be of use to you, and it is, and I'm being a bit selfish, and I'll tell you why, my motives in mentioning this at all. I've been pressing RTE to do something on a more regular basis for the Irish abroad. So they have agreed that there will be a monthly programme starting at the end of January with a working title of The Irish Abroad. We're trying to do something a bit more clever in terms of soundbite, but that's the working title of it, because essentially that's what it is. It's about The Irish Abroad. And it will be a magazine format where we hope to talk to people involved in Irish activities across the world. But obviously, for logistics and the whole scope of the Irish diaspora is so vast that there's no way we're going to be able to do it in great detail. But we hope to touch on the issues by talking to the people who are actively involved. The emphasis will almost inevitably be on the UK and the US, with presumably Australia and various other things. And to give you one small example, some of you may know this already, but I only discovered it a few months ago. The GAA are very well organised in various Irish, wherever the Irish have gathered across the world. And earlier this year, they came together in Barcelona, where they had a sort of intra-country football tournament that ran over the weekend, and where there were people from Singapore, from Hong Kong, from parts of Europe and from Australia. That's the sort of thing that we feel that we should be letting people know about here. Also, I discovered through reading the Irish Times that there was a crime writers conference or crime writers' awards that take place in Alaska of all places each year, and the Irish authors seem to dominate the prizes in that. Again, something that I only picked up off the paper. So what I'm saying is that by hoping to link in with Ian and with those of you who are individually involved in your various activities, we hope to tap into you and we hope to be using you in order to reflect what's going on in your area of activity. That was the kicker at the end. That's what I'm, the reason, my motives in mentioning it at all, but purely as by way of information. So I hope that that will perhaps in a way help to bring out of the back room, if you will, what has been discussed here and the very important issues that are impacting the Irish abroad onto the national stage. The programme will be going out on RT Radio 1, and of course through the means of modern communications it'll be picked up on the web worldwide as well as through satellite platforms. Anyway, that's my pitch. My main reason for being here is to be the moderator for two very distinguished people, one of whom I know very well and the other of whom I know by reputation. I should say I know both of them by their reputations, but one I know personally. Patsy McGarry and I have known each other a long time. He's from Roscommon, I'm from Leitrim, so that tells its own story. And he is someone whom I've long admired for his writings and for the position that he takes in a variety of different issues that I'm sure you're familiar with. And also Philip Orr, who I will introduce a little later on, and of course Noreen as well, who will be talking about political participation. But by way of introducing Patsy, it's a very topical and interesting subject, and the media and the Irish abroad. And I couldn't help but reflect, for example, on the way the media is treating the current controversy about the undocumented Irish in America. It's quite extraordinary. Maybe like you, I'm sort of biased, but I would have thought that there would have been a national consensus among the media, and that this was a good thing to be pursuing. As to whether it eventually is resolved is another issue. But I was surprised to discover that that's not quite the case at all, and that in fact the media are quite divided in relation to how they approach this. And that's only one of many, many, many issues, but I'm sure Patsy will deal with these in his own inimitable fashion. So, ladies and gentlemen and friends, without much further ado, Patsy McGarry.
Well, I had something prepared. I discovered it's all relevant to this conference, however, part of the joys of my job. Before I go any further, the last time I met Pascal was at the conference last June in Roscommon. I was covering it for the paper. And since then, to my own regret, but I know to the regret of an awful lot of people in our constituency, which is the same one, Roscommon's Leitrim or Roscommon South Leitrim now, Pascal was not reappointed to the Seanad by the Taoiseach. And a decision that perplexes a lot of people in the constituency, within his own party organisation, and indeed at a wider national level. Not least because, this may be unfair, but the man who was appointed had stood in the election and lost his seat. Many people in Roscommon would feel for very good reasons. And when it came to a choice between the two, the Taoiseach chose the man who had his own separate income and a questionable track record, instead of a man who was dependent upon his public service income and who has a very honourable record in that capacity in the Seanad and indeed in this particular area as well. It's one of Bertie's decisions, one of these decisions by him that we just don't understand. And it is a matter of great regret, and Pascal, for what it's worth, you have a lot of support, as you probably already know anyhow, in Roscommon and Leitrim. And we are sure, and we hope you'll be back very, very soon. James Joyce said that his role as an artist was to create in the smithy of his soul the uncreated conscience of his nation. Well, I would say our role, those of us in the media who have particular passions, is to prick the conscience of the nation. And particularly in this area, for somebody like myself from the west of Ireland, my own family, indeed on both sides, we experienced immigration going back as far as memory takes us. For instance, on my father's side, his uncle, John, and his two aunts went to the United States, and once his parents, or rather their parents, died, we never heard from them again. We don't know where they are. I have two brothers who immigrated in the 1980s to Philadelphia. They're still there. One of them is undocumented. In fact, of the next generation of my family, by name, there are now more McGarrys in the United States than there are in Ireland. So, I mean, immigration is very much a personal issue. where I'm concerned. And to add to that, we had a pub in Ballyhadrine, County Roscommon, and every Christmas and summer, the highlight was the arrival of the lads home from England, who went on a spree for about 2 weeks. And we were often part of that spree ourselves, particularly at Christmas time because they're all there together. In the summertime, it tended to be a bit more spread out. So immigration is a very real issue for people like me, and for people, and I'm not remote or unusual in media in that sense. And I think it's something that people in organisations which are involved in the immigration issue don't often realise, that they're tapping onto a very sympathetic source there when they go to media in the main. And just as examples of what media can do and how it can be have an impact, I will just tell you about a few examples. I mean, the task force report was a hugely significant event in evolving Irish attitudes to our immigrants abroad. And that was published in 2002. But, I mean, these reports, like all reports, tend to be quite dry and quite statistical. And to reach the people, to move the people, to get at their consciences, you need something like prime time. In December of 2003, I don't think we could ever overestimate the powerful impact of that programme on the people of Ireland in the main. When you see elderly Irish, mainly men, living in such appalling and shocking conditions in parts of Britain, it really it took people by surprise. It absolutely shocked them. It was an issue that most people weren't aware of. And indeed, I'll explain, it personally had quite a profound impact as well. It brought me back to the people I was talking about, because many of those possibly are in that situation. It brought me back to my own student days when I lived, when I was in Galway, and I used to go to London for to work during the summer months. I was in the US as well. And I met a lot of elderly Irish in both places. One man on a building site in London was called Ted. He was from the west of Ireland, and he was in his 50s, which I thought then was very, very old. I was about 18. And he took me under his wing, and he got all the soft jobs for me. But there was a routine. At the end of the day, he went to the pub. And then every Friday he went to the pub and he stayed there most of the day, and he used to bring me along with him, and I was not able to keep up with Ted. But I've often wondered since what happened to that man. I mean, it's 20, 25 years ago. He was in his late 50s. He clearly, to me, would have made no provision for a pension or otherwise. And he was the one that came to mind when I saw that primetime programme. So a few of us got together and decided to organise a concert here in Dublin, which we did do. Some colleagues in the media, mainly just personal friends of my own from the west of Ireland, and I think Seamus might have been there, I don't know. We organised it up in the Vicar Street, excuse me. And really the purpose of the concert wasn't so much to raise money, which we did do, it was as to raise awareness, to heighten the awareness on the back of the primetime programme the year before. And in order to do that, I circulated people in the media generally, and they all responded very positively. People like the Pat Kinney Show, the Marion Finucane Show, people in local radio, etc. And it just highlighted to me yet again that this is a route that can be exploited, and can be exploited very, very effectively where the issue is concerned. My own papers in Hoshi Ningen over to London to meet some people. I have their stories here, but I don't think this is the time to tell because I'm bridges are converted. And it had a very powerful impact in December of 2004. And our own paper wrote a leader on it at the time. And it's just that added into the momentum that was already growing after the task force report. And we followed on the year after with another concert in Castlebar, an open-air concert, which was coincident with an exhibition which was arranged with the Country Museum down there, which is part of the National Museum of Ireland, to mount an exhibition on the experience of Irish immigration in England in the 50s and 60s. And both were very successful. And again, it was about raising awareness. We did raise money. The money went to the Ashling Centre, which Karen may be aware of. They have already been providing holidays for people, elderly, mainly Irish people in the UK, in London particularly, bringing them to Ireland. And they've also got involved in something else very significant, resettlement of people who want to come back here and helping them. There's been varying degrees of success there. But they've done some very, very good work. And laterally, we contributed something to the Cricklewood Homeless Centre as well. But really, I suppose, where media is concerned, our primary function in this area, I would believe, is simply to raise people's awareness about what's going on out there, particularly where elderly Irish immigrants are concerned. I have to say something that I was a bit surprised by. The comparative reaction here in the city, which was very positive to the issue and very sympathetic, to what happened down in the west of Ireland, in Castlebar and in Mayo. I can't explain it, but we really had to push people so hard to interest them in the issue at all, and to indeed to come along to the concert. And I don't understand it, because Mayo, like my own county, Roscommon, or indeed West Roscommon, was so profoundly affected by immigration all the way along the line, and not least in the 1980s, when even the Ballyhadrian could hardly field a football team, because all the young fellas were gone. But so I don't know, but there's a certain, maybe it's the old fatalism that was such a curse of the Irish for so long. But I don't think it should be, we should be dissuaded by it. But as I say, that's where I see the media having a primary role in the campaign itself, in, if you like, creating the climate whereby government can afford to allocate very significant amounts of money to this particular area, and I mean, without meeting public resistance, and that's been the experience so far. So if we're just facilitating, if you like, the issue. On a more simple level, I suppose, I think it's very important that we make sure that as many outlets in England as possible have access to the provincial papers. I know our own paper at the moment has been a big push in the last year to 2 years to increase sales internationally, but particularly in the UK. But I have to be honest about it and say that most of the people who will be buying papers in the UK would be from my own part of the world, and they would not be Irish Times readers. They'd probably have read the Irish Press if it was still in existence, and maybe the Independent, but who wants to add to the profits of Tony O'Reilly? Anyhow, that's a petty point. But I just think that the provincial papers are the ones they want to read, and that brings me into something else which maybe Brian can advise us on. When people talk about RTE and how important it is for people to have access to RTE, and I agree with that, particularly where football matches are concerned. But the RTE that people in the UK remember is a very different institution to what it is today, and they wouldn't identify as keenly with it as probably we still, or some of us still, believe to be the case. But what we should try and look at is find ways technically whereby they can access local radio, particularly along the whole West Coast. If you look at radio in Ireland, local radio along the West Coast of Ireland is vastly more popular than any of the national stations, and because they're really closely clued in to their communities. And I don't know how, I'm sure the technology must be available now through iPods or through internet, whereby, but then again, most of these people wouldn't have the internet or know how to operate it, to make local radio accessible, particularly in the UK, but not just in the UK. I think that should be investigated or looked at, even by government institutions and foreign affairs, etc. It's really a technical matter. But overall, I suppose, we have to remember too that this is essentially a dying population. They're getting older all the time, so which is why I think the work that Carm and people like that are doing is very, very important to help them to renew contact. Most of them would have lost with families for reasons like my granduncle and grandaunts, that after their parents died, they just lost their interest, if you like, and the motivation to stay in contact with their own families or their own people. And I think that would be an area we should really all concentrate on, whether it be in media or as organisations in the future. There's another element to all of this which I think I don't think has dawned on people at governmental level anyway, and I'm not including Jim in this obviously, is the how significant our own experience in this area has been for what may happen here in our own country in the future, where our new, God knows, I can't get the right phrase, foreign nationals, new Irish, you pick the title, are concerned. I think there's an awful lot to be learned there. I think because the patterns are strikingly similar. You see young Poles at home in Ballardrain or wherever, and there are quite a few of them there as there are elsewhere, and they live a lifestyle which is absolutely a mirror image of the way young Irish men lived in London. They work hard all week, they go on the batter at the weekend, not in the pubs actually, they tend to buy the drink and bring it home, because it's cheaper that way of course. They send practically everything home. Somebody this morning talked about, well, I think it was Alan, about how much they save for themselves. Very little, clearly, whatever they have, it goes home. So those men, and they are mainly young men, won't and don't make any effort to integrate. They're here to make money, maybe to go back. Some of them will probably find themselves in similar situations to a lot of elderly Irish men currently in the UK. I think there are great lessons there to be learned for how we address migration in this country from the experience of groups like this abroad. And if I may, before I finish, I'd like to, and it's not often that the church experiences praise from this particular quarter, I mean the media, I really think we have to take our hat off to the Catholic Church in particular for the role it has played in dealing with Irish immigrants, whether in the UK, the United States, or Australia, long before the state became involved, it was there helping out people. And I know this from my own experience as a kid in London when I went over as a student. They were there, they were active on the ground, and they are still there, and I think we should take off our hats to them for that particular role. Thank you all very much.
Thank you very much, Patsy, and I'd say on a personal level, very kind of you. Comments
from my time, the truth.
And for the benefit of those of you who may not know, Patsy might be surprised that I know, he writes a column, it's the Midland Tribune. And I have a brother in law who lives in Tullamore, who some weeks after the election passed on Patsy's writings in that particular week. So I have to tell you that. Very humbling to me, what he had to say, and it's very grateful for the kind comments. Touch your word there. And as is often said by Law Era around Waylock, there is another day of the hustings. I have had a lifelong interest in Irish soldiers abroad. It's one of those little quirks of my personality that I also have an interest in stamp collecting, so I'll give you an idea. And it goes way back to the fact I come from Shambo and County Leitrim, which had three churches. It has still the Church of Ireland, Methodist Church, which is right across the road from where I grew up, and the Catholic Church. My father grew up in a pub, and the pub was right across the road from the Church of Ireland, and they had very strong links with the community, naturally enough, as often happened in many rural communities. And in both the Methodist Church and in the Church of Ireland, there are plaques to the memory of those who served in the First World War. There are no such plaques in the Catholic Church. It's part of our history, sadly, a divided history and a controversial one. And I became very friendly with a man who had served in the Connaught Rangers. I knew him. I'm showing my age now. Our common interest at the time, I was quite young, 11 or 12, was in horse racing. Another one of my vices then. I have to tell you, I've shed it much since when I learned that the horses always won. But he had, not the bookies always won, not the horses. But anyway, he had a great interest, and I used to go up to the house, and I served at his daughter's wedding, for which I got a shiny half crown, to which I was eternally grateful, and I felt that that was a house that would welcome me. But it transpired that he had served, along with two of his brothers, and three of them went off to war, and only one came back. And then about 12, 13 years ago, I was here in Dublin and got an invitation to go along to the Dublin Civic Museum, where they were providing space for a newly formed commemorative organisation called the Royal Dublin Fusiliers Association, with a man called Tom Burke. And Dick Spring was there that night as Foreign Minister, and I think it was the first time that there was any sort of official government recognition given to the provision, to the acknowledgement that there was this very strong strand within Irish history, and the Civic Museum was providing space for memorabilia. And I met a woman from my home area who came to that meeting that night, and I was surprised that she was there and said, "You'll come up," and she had with her a little tobacco box, in which she had the medals of her granduncle, whom she never knew, and letters that he had written when he was in then Palestine, where the particular regiment he was with were doing their training before they went into combat. And she said they'd never talked about it in their family. And I just thought today, when I knew that Philip was going to be here, how Ireland has been so transformed. I'm a member of the Royal Dublin Fusiliers Association since that time, and I'm also a member of what became formed shortly after that, in the mid-90s, of the Connaught Rangers Commemorative Association, who meet in Boyle. And Seamus Galley would be familiar with King House, which was the garrison headquarters of the Connaught Rangers. And I've been over to Ypres, and I've been to the various other places that are associated with the Connaught Rangers. So when I heard that Philip was coming here and was going to talk about the contribution of Irish soldiers abroad, I felt it was very apt, because it fits into the New Ireland and the fact that we now have We have taken away the screens, as it were, and we have exposed a new generation, my own children as well, to the fact that these were very dedicated, commissioned, passionate Irishmen who, when they went out to fight for the freedom of small nations, they believed that they were also fighting for the freedom of their own nation. And that has now been officially acknowledged and is now a given. I think it shows how far we've come as a nation. So I'm particularly pleased that Philip is here, and we're working extensively in this who has a number of books and publications, one on the Battle of the Somme and the other on Gallipoli, in which the Irish were very heavily involved. So you're very welcome.
Thank you. Thanks very much for your welcome. Just when Patsy was talking there, I was thinking that myself, coming from a northern Protestant family from County Down, County Antrim, we also had emigration in the family as well, and I've got uncles and aunts who tended to head to Australia on the £5 fare in the boat, which was available back then. So, I mean, it's fascinating just how much all across this nation and every corner of it, you know, immigration plays a key part. I'll try to scoot through this as quickly as I can, and if I find that I'm going over the time, just rein me in and I'll squeeze things down towards the end. Down through history, soldiering has been a key part of Irish emigrant experience, I think. Hundreds of thousands of Irishmen fought for the British Empire at battles, such as Waterloo, or against that empire with the armies of nations as diverse as Spain and Bavaria. Poverty and disaffection drove many to seek a life abroad as a serviceman. Many of them didn't come home, or if they did, they returned to communities in which they now felt ill at ease. The absent son gone to be a soldier boy was a feature of all too many Irish families. Nor should we forget those rebel emigres who, banished from Ireland because of their allegiances, plotted revolution from castles in Scotland or salons in Paris. I want to look with you at perhaps the most important episode of soldiering in Irish history, the First World War, a conflict in which well over 200,000 Irishmen fought and well over 30,000 Irishmen died, and to look at it as a kind of emigrant experience, even though it only lasted for most of them for only 4 years. It's a period of our history that, as you've rightly pointed out, has been interpreted in two ways in our island, at least until recently. For Unionists, the memories of the deaths of the trenches was to be revered as an emblem of loyalty. For Nationalists, the memory of those deaths was to be a source of darker sentiments, coloured perhaps by some shame and some embarrassment, as a resurgent Irish nation sought now to loosen the hold of its old imperial master. But what can't be denied is that Irishmen from every county and from every political persuasion fought in that terrible war in locations that were incredibly diverse, from Mesopotamia to Flanders. Every one of them volunteers. What can't be denied either is that it was an intense emigrant experience. You'd only need to be here on the streets of this city on the 29th of April 1915 with all the other crowds numbering up to 50,000 men, women and children who were watching the 17,000 soldiers of the 10th Division as they marched along the quays to the docks where they take the boats that would eventually take them to the killing fields of Gallipoli. The majority of those young men didn't return, and those who did walked the streets of a land that they now found irrevocably changed by political events that had taken place in their absence. Many families were left with a sheaf of letters and a hazy sense of some distant graveyard where their loved one lay. A good place to start in looking at the parallel between soldiering and the overall Irish emigrant experience is the motivation for departure. For many, it was economic and social hardship that took them to the recruiting office as to the emigrant ship. On the streets of Belfast, men in dead-end jobs without the skills to get a job in the foundry or the shipyard sought the chance of a regular wage when war came. And here in Dublin, men made redundant in the Dublin pre-war labour disputes also joined the forces, motivated by the thought of regular meals, a decent wage and the allowance for their wife and children. Bartholomew Hand, who laboured at a tough, ill-paid job on the Powers Court domain, joined up in Dublin city centre and went off to Gallipoli with the 10th Division. Tommy Irvine from East Belfast left a home impoverished by drunken parents to join the 36th Division and ended up wounded at the Somme. Many men, dulled by the drudgery of life in an Ireland still crippled in so many ways by a famine that had taken place within living memory, sought the vivid adventure of life in the forces. In an era when many folks scarcely left their own townland or their own village, life promised foreign travel in the troops, comradeship and victory over the enemy that would be just as easy as defeating those tribesmen in corners of the far-flung empire. And indeed, as with all Irish emigrants, foreign places would open up to these soldiers, bringing with them a taste of life in towns from London to Salonika. Initially, all Irish soldiers trained in England with opportunities for weekend leaves in nearby locations like Brighton and Bournemouth. letters home from those men who could write, spoke of wonder at the picturesque home counties, villages, and the imperial grandeur of London. My own great uncle, John Martin, walked from his camp over the downs to Eastbourne to watch Negro minstrels perform in the pier, listening all the while to the sound of the guns coming from France across the Channel. Thousands of Irish soldiers decanted into France, tried to learn the language, to chat up the local girls, and to order strange drinks in pubs that seemed very unfamiliar. Those who fought further afield had an even richer geographical experience. Many men of the 10th Division stopped off at Malta to admire Valletta Harbour, then docked at Alexandria, where many of them visited the cafes, the music halls, and of course, the brothels. And on arriving on the Greek islands in all their summer splendour, many thought themselves to be in the most beautiful place they'd ever seen and wrote home about it or took pictures. A few days later, they were perishing in the hellfires of Gallipoli, fighting in an unfamiliar terrain against Turks for whom August 1915 wasn't August 1915, but the month of Ramadan. These men who survived Gallipoli found themselves on the icy hills of Serbia fighting Bulgarians. Later, they would sip iced drinks in the street cafes of Salonika. Nor should we forget those Irishmen who were taken prisoner, like Albert Bruce from Lisburn, who learnt German and socialism, doing forced labour in a Hamburg shipyard that was fast heading towards revolution. What's clear then is that during 4 years of war, soldiering brought tens of thousands of Irishmen into contact with foreign cultures and foreign lands just as surely as any immigrant journey. Emigration does, of course, result in an intensified, modified, and sometimes uncomfortable sense of one's own national identity, whether on the streets of London or elsewhere. For Great War soldiers, this story also held true. The 36th Ulster Division, packed to the brim with orange men, found themselves viewed with bemused amusement by the English inhabitants of the town where they were based as they celebrated the 12th of July, complete with orange sashes and a man riding a horse dressed up as King Billy. A few weeks later in France, they gazed at the roadside shrines and Catholic chapels and wondered had they chosen the right side to fight alongside. Fighting alongside Englishmen, Scots, Welsh, men from the Empire, they came to recognise themselves as the notorious Ulstermen who had brought the North to the brink of conflict in the pre-war years. And fighting alongside the Nationalists of the 16th Irish Division, they learned a wary respect for men they'd been arming themselves to fight 3 years before. As for an Irish Nationalist such as the poet Francis Ledwidge with the 10th Division, in Gallipoli and Macedonia, the conflict between his Irishness and his membership of the British Army soon became quite unbearable, especially when his friend Thomas MacDonagh was shot as a leader of the Easter Rising and he had to bear the taunts of his fellow soldiers about Irish treachery, fellow soldiers whom he must also loyally fight alongside. The Great War was, of course, a crucible of emerging national identity for the Turks and the Australians at Gallipoli, for the Canadians advancing out of their trenches at Vimy Ridge. And arguably, Irish camaraderie in uniform, albeit in the uniform of the Empire they were about to shake off, also helped solidify a sense of identity in the thousands of men who, on the return from the trenches, would join the IRA. For many Irish soldiers abroad, homesickness and a sense of loss was as much an issue as it was for any emigrant. Letters to and from the front were read intensively for every bit of news that could be discerned. Private Tom McKinney from Carnmoney in County Antrim kept inquiring about life on the home farm called Sentry Hill, which fields were being sown with barley, which horses were being used for the ploughing, how were the chickens coming along this year, presents from home arrived constantly at the front, even eggs were sent out from County Antrim and got smashed in transit. Tom sent back souvenirs, including the cap with a hole in it, where he had been nearly shot by a German bullet. He did not, of course, mention the gas attacks and the comrades caught in the barbed wire, riddled by machine gun bullets. And just as every wave of Irish immigration left its mark on foreign shores, Gaelicising whole streets and districts of Liverpool and Glasgow and the towns in America and elsewhere, so the Irish soldiers left behind in a more temporary way on the places that they were visiting a sense of Irishness. The 10th Division soldiers marched through the streets of Alexandria and no doubt turned the heads of the natives as the Irish regimental bands played Brian Boru's March and A Nation Once Again. In the street cafes near the harbour, the Irish soldiers turned the place into an Irish pub in the Mediterranean, singing God Save Ireland, Say the Heroes, and it's a long way to Tipperary until the small hours. Later, as they installed themselves in the fatal peninsula of Gallipoli, they named their trenches in the Dublin Fusiliers Grafton Street and Dawson Street, and the men from Cork named their trenches Patrick Street. And in the graveyards of Gallipoli, there are whole stretches that read like an Irish street directory. If you've never been there, go there to see it. At Cape Helles, on the southern tip of Gallipoli, you can see the names of gravestone after gravestone: O'Doherty, O'Dwyer, O'Driscoll, Harney, Barry, all the Irish names. Men who had travelled from Europe's western edge to find a grave at its eastern edge. Elsewhere in Europe, the Irishness of Great War soldiers still leaves its mark on a far-off landscape, as in Macedonia, for instance, where a memorial Celtic cross rises on a hill at Rebrovo, overlooking a place entirely inhabited by Islamic people. It is true that a feature of being an immigrant is that you may find returning home afterwards a somewhat discomforting thing, and I'm sure that many coming back to find Ireland transformed by the Celtic tiger find that disorienting in some ways. Great War soldiers were mostly away for no more than 4 years, apart from the 30,000 who'd been in the army already at the beginning of the war, but a lot had happened in that time. By 1918, Sinn Féin had risen to challenge and defeat the old Nationalist Party of John Redmond, and Sinn Féin had stood on an anti-conscription ticket opposed to the imposition of conscription to the army of all fit adult males, something that never actually happened in the end. Soldiers on leave found their uniform an unwelcome sight on many streets. After the Great War was over, it wouldn't be long before the War of Independence came along. And whilst many nationalist ex-combatants joined the IRA and many unionist soldiers joined the police in the north, many other soldiers just lay low and felt uncomfortable and didn't talk about their experience. Physical disability was often coupled by psychiatric problems, and the military hospital at Leopardstown was crowded with men seeking help for what we now call post-traumatic stress disorder. Joe O'Leary from Skerries nursed tubercular lungs, an injured leg, a burst eardrum, and serious mental problems. At the same time as trying to reconnect with his old peacetime existence, run a shop in his hometown, marry and raise a family. But he never properly got his old life back, growing more and more isolated and prone to spells of anxiety and depression. After his wife died, he could no longer cope with the business, nor raising his children. The children were farmed out to other people in the family. Joe took on bits and pieces of work as a cobbler and gradually became more and more isolated. Tommy Jordan struggled to get back into his home life in Belfast, suffering from tinnitus that tortured him day and night. He couldn't walk to the bottom of the garden without looking at barbed wire, and the barbed wire reminded him of what he'd seen in the trenches. Hugh James Adams, brutalised by 4 years in the 36th Division, came back and joined the RUC's B Specials and went up and down the Falls Road taking shots at chimney pots, transferring his wartime anger into fury at the Nationalist population. Even the plan by the British government to build houses for Irish ex-servicemen to help them find comfort created huge problems in an Irish Free State where such housing was seen as an unfair privilege and isolated the old soldiers still further, the areas very often ending up where they were living with laconic names such as the Dardanelles and Little Britain. As one old Dublin Fusilier from Donnybrook called Bartholomew Hand said to his family, "The day they painted the pillar boxes green was the worst day of my life. We were far better under the Empire than this Free State." But the soldiers themselves experienced many disturbing dilemmas after their absence from Ireland. Their families, friends and neighbours also knew all about the difficulties presented by their absence. For those soldiers' wives who had large families to sustain, there was an undoubted benefit. There were 22 shillings of extra allowance for a wife at home with four children, for example, which would bring the earnings closer to the 30 shillings earned by a skilled tradesman at the time. And this kind of remuneration in the absence of a husband who was overseas is perhaps some kind of parallel to the money sent home by Irish emigrants who had departed for good or else went in search of seasonal labour. However, there can be no doubt that the loss of a key family member to the army left a hole in the fabric of so many families. Just as with emigration, where several members of the same family might follow one another out to the same place, So too it was frequently the case that members of the same family followed one another into the forces. Boys in the Lee family of South Dublin, a shop-owning family, went to fight in 1914 and two never returned. The Findletters, another famous commercial Dublin family, also lost two boys killed in action. In Belfast, the Mabin family, working class loyalists on the Shankill, lost two boys. Both died at the Somme. Private Glavy from Athlone was a company cook with the Connaught Rangers in Gallipoli, who perished in a volley of Turkish machine gun fire in 1915, leaving three young sons fighting with other regiments on the Western Front. Indeed, just as emigration could rob whole Irish communities of their best and brightest young men, so too could Great War soldiering. There were towns that had military barracks and traditions of enlistment, such as Enniskillen and Limerick. Villages like Dollingstown in County Armagh, where one young man after another followed into the troops. Because of the recruitment practice in those days, people joined up on a regional basis, which was thought to be good for soldiering because you were fighting alongside your cousin or perhaps your neighbour. That meant that one well-trained German machine gunner could take out a whole Irish townland with his fire. This left many people and many communities in distress. And just take another 3 or 4 minutes if that's okay with you. Because of the proportionately higher number of men who went to the war from Protestant communities, this left many Protestants feeling particularly vulnerable in the Free State after partition, having lost maybe one, maybe more son who might have had the dynamism to maintain a family business in the new and challenging climate. For families separated from their soldier boys throughout the war, letters, photos, mementos were crucially important, as they would be for any emigrants. My great uncle John, serving with the Ulster Division, was scarcely able to write, but he sent ill-spelt letters home and seasonal Christmas cards until he ended up in a prisoner of war camp and was killed by friendly fire, as it's now called, when a French airplane came over and bombed the camp. But his photograph, mounted and beautifully placed in the stairwell of my grandmother's home, was an inspiration to me as a boy looking at it. And such ways did Irish families try to remember someone who had vanished out of their lives forever. But most Irish families had to console themselves with the thought that they would never see their loved one's grave after he had died. And again, a comparable thing for many separated by emigration across the broad Atlantic. Many Irishmen had gone missing in the chaos. Their graves weren't even to be seen. Others were buried in Turkey, many, many miles away, or in Mesopotamia, even today, Iraq, a place that it would be difficult to go and visit. What I would like to mention in conclusion is that for some families, the twin feature of emigration and Great War experience led to a complete disinheritance in the family. The McKinney family in County Antrim that I mentioned earlier had a boy called Tom who went out and died in France. He was the only boy in the household, and it would have been passed then to other male members of the family to inherit the farm. But those male members, the cousins of the family, had all emigrated to Australia and Nigeria and America. And there was no one to take over the farm, except in this case a sister and an old maiden aunt who couldn't do that. And so when Tom's father died in the 30s, the farm was ready to go back out of the family. And it's only today, since Newton Abbey Borough Council has bought the property, that it has become a wonderful museum to Ulster country life, but also a testimony to the way in which one family completely lost its inheritance, if you like, in the Irish countryside due to the twin features of emigration and the war. So I'd like to conclude by echoing once again that in the past, this story was very much seen as being a possession of the Unionists, possession of those who were still pro-British, and in many ways something that was in the dark or in the shadows as far as the Irish Republic was concerned, and indeed Irish nationalists in the north. Thankfully that has changed a great deal, and one of the things that perhaps we should remember is that, as with emigration, at the end of the day it's a story of individuals, the story of how individuals experienced both positive and the dark side of travelling away from their homeland. And fortunately, in the 1980s, before they died, I managed to get a chance to talk to a lot of the old veterans and speak to them. And I'll just read to you, to conclude, some of the things that they said to me about that war. "You were in it, and you couldn't get out of it. By the time we'd been a while in France, we saw the folly of the whole thing. sent out there to fight against people we've no grudge against, in the same boat as ourselves. I can think of nothing but what might have been and the golden friends I had, and what I want to convey is my fury that they were locked into chains for execution. Many's the time when I'm in bed, these things come back to me, and I can't get to sleep just when I don't want them to. No, you don't forget. Ladies and gentlemen, if old soldiers don't forget, I believe then neither should we. Their story is ours, as Irish men and women. It's part of our heritage, no matter what our persuasion, in any kind of way. I hope that's presented to you, the story, in a reasonably vivid way, and as perhaps might be the purpose of bringing me here to talk today, just to expand out and diversify the sense of what emigration means. That in fact all those men in the First World War are only part of a whole bunch of Irish soldiers, right stretching back to the 17th century and maybe earlier, right to today, who have found themselves abroad and their families dislocated from them because they felt obliged or felt the need to travel abroad to be a soldier. Thank you.
Thank you very much for bridging many gaps in your knowledge. A very strong trend has been running through the Irish experience in this country in the last 80, 90 years. I couldn't help but reflect that one of my proudest moments as a member of the Senate was in the last 2 years when I espoused, along with many others who were much more worthy than me and had been doing it for much longer, the cause of the Shot of Dawn soldiers. Some 307 of them who were effectively just taken out of the shot. When Philip was making a reference to the beauty of Salonika, I couldn't help but reflect on that one of those who was shot at dawn was because it seems that he was a bit of a maverick in his regiment or in his platoon, and he was got up on a charge by an officer because he didn't have his cap on the right way, and he refused to obey the order of the officer to fix his cap properly. Consequently, he was course-martialed, and because he had done it in full view of all of his contemporaries, he pleaded guilty, not realising that in pleading guilty the implications were tragic for him, as ultimately he was shot, executed as an example, for the sake of example, I think was the term that was used. And that was one of the sad aspects of it. But as I say, I was very, very honoured to have been part of that, and that has now been resolved because the British government finally acknowledged their wrong in that regard. The other thing I couldn't help but reflect on was when Philip was talking about some of the memories of those, or the recollections that things were better under the Empire, is that some of you, I think, are around long enough to have remembered RT television at the time of the 50th anniversary of the Rising of 1916. They did a feature documentary on the Rising, and it ran each night during Easter week of that period, 1966. And there is historically one fact that happened when there was a group of hussars that charged down O'Connell Street to scatter the rebels that had taken over the GPO. And when rehearsals were going on, it's an apocryphal story, by the way, but it's a very interesting one. When they were rehearsing that particular scene, it seems a little old Dublin lady stuck her head out the door and saw these hussars in their full finery in front of her, and she said, "Oh, thank God you're back." So it kind of reflects on the sort of crisis of identity that all of us have. Anyway, I want to ask, Noreen is going to talk to us now about the political participation, and Noreen, those of you who know, has been the driving force of the amendment in this conference, and we've spoken on a number of occasions, particularly in the last few weeks. So, over to you.
Okay.
I'm
just
going to take the seat to your left.
Yeah. Great, thanks. Okay. All right, so what I'm going to talk to you today is about political participation, and I know that there's been a lot of arguments over the last few decades, really, about what kind of role people who live abroad should be allowed to take in elections. But what I would like to do is talk about the changing international perspective. As you'll see, it's becoming extremely more popular for people to be allowed to vote from outside the country. So, my first point is that external voting is already reality in Ireland. We had a lot of coverage over the past year, people lining up at the French embassy to vote and people lining up at the Polish embassies to vote. And the media coverage of that has been generally positive. I saw no articles questioning why these immigrants who were living in another country were voting from Ireland for their elections in their home country. And I think that that's a very strong contrast to the reaction that many people have when they think about allowing Irish people to vote when they are living abroad. There are now 115 countries and territories, including nearly every developed nation, that has provisions for external voting. And by external voting, I really mean immigrant voting. They're roughly the same thing. The number is growing enormously, and the publications on the subject are increasing. This publication actually just came out this past month. I had it delivered to me just only last week, and it's put out by an organization that assists international, it's an international organization rather, that assists mainly developing nations with their own elections. But they've compiled an amazing table of every country. It's, I think, 205 countries, 214 countries in the world, and what their voting rights are. And if you look, they have a table where they say the first year that the voting rights have been implemented. And about a third of these have only had voting in the last 10 years or so. So it's something that is really increasing at a quite a dramatic rate, really. I don't know if anybody knows anything at all about the history of immigrant voting, but it was actually the first, it was the state of Wisconsin in 1850, which was the first jurisdiction that allowed for people to vote, it must have been 1860 rather, sorry, because there were soldiers serving in the Civil War, so they allowed for absentee voting there. That was the first. So in 150 years, we've gone to 115 countries. And also there's been academic publications have also been increasing on this. The first publication that I ever saw, I think, was about 2005 was the date on it, and there's been a number of publications since then. So there's an academic interest as well. Okay, this is just an idea of the global span, 41 countries in Europe, 28 in Africa. So you see there, it's 16 in North and South America, 20 in Asia, and 10 in the Pacific region. And that, it, again, it includes almost every developed nation. Even very high immigrant nations are now starting to allow their countries, their external citizens, to vote. You see there Italy, the Philippines, Dominican Republic. Dominican Republic actually allowed it after an extensive campaign by Dominicans abroad as well, Mexico. And Ghana and Panama are introducing it now. It's not all political idealism that is motivating this. Sometimes it's for the advantage of a ruling power to have its citizens voting. Just like that's, it's just political reality sometimes that it does favor some party, so they would back it. Just saying, there's a variety of reasons why people would be allowing this. There are more countries that are discussing introducing external voting, including several where they have the provisions, but they don't have the legislation to enact those provisions, including Comoros there, which is a tiny African island nation. When we think about what form does immigrant voting take, I think a lot of times people are frightened of it. They think it's an all-or-nothing proposition, that people might be overrun by the number of immigrants that there are, that they would exert an extreme amount of power. But most countries actually have exercised a lot of discretion. It tends to be a long process to figure out how would be the best way to represent immigrant interests. So I'll just take a look at a number of those. The choices people have come around, who can vote, what types of elections they can vote in, from which constituencies are their votes going to be accepted, and by what method. So we'll just do a little tour here. A study in 2006 of just about 90-something countries that allow their citizens to vote from abroad found that 65 countries allow external voting for everyone, while 26 countries had restrictions. And those restrictions involved the length of stay, a stated intent to return, which again is a very hard thing to prove, and then the location where the immigrants are now living. Some places that do in-person voting would have to limit the number of countries that they can administer that from. There are a few countries that disqualify citizens from voting after periods of non-residence. These include Germany, which is 25 years unless you're living in a Council of Europe country, and then there's no limits on it. The UK is 15 years, recently reduced from 20. Canada, it's 5 years. New Zealand is 3 consecutive years without a physical presence, but all you need to do to reactivate your vote for New Zealand is return to re-register. There are 3 types of elections that external citizens would be allowed to vote in. The national and presidential would be the most commonly allowed ones. Then there's also local and regional and referendums. These two are tend to be less available to immigrant voters. And then there's 2 options for constituency. You can either vote in the last constituency of your residence. Most countries follow this line. The U.S. would follow this. Or you're participating in a discrete district that has been set up solely for the representation of citizens abroad. There are 9 countries that reserve seats in their parliament. A few of these are kind of interesting. Croatia actually sets its number of immigrant seats determined by voter turnout. And that was after an experience that they had where they had few immigrant voters, but a lot of seats assigned to those. They decided that wasn't fair, so they adapted it. France has another interesting case. The French actually vote for a 100-member elected group of representatives that work with the French Department of Foreign Affairs, and they, in turn, then elect 12 representatives for their parliament. Colombia set up a five-person electoral district to represent minorities, immigrants, black people, indigenous people, and political minorities. But they set 1 of those seats for immigrants specifically. So, and then Italy has 12 seats with 4 global electoral districts, which I believe is Europe, the Americas, I don't know, is it Asia, then Africa and the rest of the world, something like that. So, and most of these seats would be somewhat under 5%. Some of them are 1.2%, let's say, of the seats in the parliament. It would be a fairly low number. And I haven't really researched it very much, but it doesn't seem directly proportional to the amount of people that they have abroad. It just tends to be a low number that would give them some participation. There are 3 methods of external voting. One is in person. And so that would include consulates and embassy opportunities as well as people who have to return home. And that's the most popular one. There's also mail or fax. And then 3 countries you can vote by proxy. There are other countries that actually allow proxy and in-person or proxy and mail. And then the Netherlands, as far as I know, is the only country that allows e-voting right now. We won't really talk about that in the Irish context right now, but maybe sometime in the future this will be more useful. But we won't hold our breath on that one. So postal voting is becoming increasingly common, and it has a lot of advantages, and it's inexpensive, and you can use it anywhere in the world. But there are some concerns about fraud. It is a hard thing to manage, sending out the ballot and getting it back, and it's also privacy issues. So it is an issue. One of the things about external voting is you're going to have a trade-off, really. If a country chooses to do this, it's never really going to be as secure as an in-country vote. And there's also in-person voting. And the main advantage of that is that the home nation can really maintain supervision over it much more closely, and voters can use the exact same methods. They can use the same kind of forms, everything. But the main problem of that is the cost and also the limits it places on people, and it just wouldn't be available to every external voter. And then there are those 4 countries that I found where people have to return home to cast their ballots. Israel, Taiwan, El Salvador, and Slovakia. And the challenges of implementation, just a little summary of them, is how are people going to register to vote? It can be expensive and time-consuming to try to maintain a list of your immigrants abroad. How are you going to get the word out that voting procedures are going on? Then there's the fraud issue. People can misrepresent themselves. We don't want them to vote twice, obviously, and we need to make sure of their eligibility. And then again, the guaranteeing secrecy issue. Okay, just to look at the Irish context now, we'll see there are some people who can vote from abroad, members of the armed forces, diplomatic staff, and then also NUI and Trinity graduates can vote in the Shannon. So, and it's not against the law. It's just that there's no law to facilitate immigrant voting. There's also nothing, there doesn't seem to be any kind of international code that would require it either. It tends to be a very individual choice. There was one couple that took a case to I think it was the European Commission on Human Rights or something, and that found against them. There's no international treaty that would require countries to allow their citizens to vote. Now, it's become timely this week with Shannon reform. Minister Gormley has said early on that he was interested in implementing Shannon reform, and this week it kind of came out that he's talking about a committee that would work toward all-party adoption of a report that was done in 2004, which has been sitting there. Nobody's done anything with it yet. And in the media coverage, it sounds so far that the most likely early outcome is reforming the university constituency, which I will come back to in a few minutes. So, but I just want to say what that report says about immigrant voting. Okay. First thing it does is it notes large-scale immigration has ended. Then it also acknowledges strong emotional arguments for giving votes, but it highlights the logistical and administrative problems, which are who would qualify, how would the register be compiled and maintained, how would the voting be organized, and if the voting were by postal ballot, how could the integrity of the electoral process be safeguarded? And it notes no one has come up with satisfactory answers. And I think that this is where maybe an international comparison comes into play, because if we look and see how other countries have done it, we see situations that have worked for other countries. So I just think that's a useful thing to keep in mind. And then it made the recommendation that it agreed in principle, that emigrants and immigrants should have a voice in the Shannon. And it says that the Taoiseach, when selecting his nominees for the Shannon, should include people who can represent the interests and perspectives of both emigrants and immigrants. Now, I welcome that, the intent of that, in that it's a positive move because it intends to give political recognition to immigrants. But my problem with that would be that it's vague, and it's also an appointment without an election. So it gives immigrants representation but not participation. And also, to me, it doesn't seem like there's any accountability there to the immigrants themselves, which I think is something that the immigrants would like. So I think that many of those who have been looking for voting rights will think it doesn't go far enough. But now, the fundamental problem with immigrant voting that I see as an extremely valid concern, and that most of the literature agrees is a valid concern, is that when you have a high proportion of immigrants abroad, this can be a threat to the democratic process, in that you can have a large population dictating to people who live here, so a large population of people who do not live in the country, and it leads to high levels of opposition within the country. So the key thing is to get a balance and to ensure that citizens who are abroad can have a say while balancing that with the rights of the people who are being ruled by the decisions. So, and again, I think that the solution is in examining the range of options that international examples provide, and also I think in Ireland there's going to be such a reduction in the proportion of the immigrants that's coming that this issue is going to become less important, because right now it would be such a significant issue because it's globally it would be among the very highest number of immigrants. So, and then I'm not going to talk about the arguments for and against, because I think that those have been really done to death, but I just want to say something about the no representation without taxation argument, which did find its way into the Shannon report the report on Shannon reform. And it also kind of dominates the debate in Ireland, but it's not an argument which is heard internationally at all. And again, I think this is something where an international perspective is useful, because the United States is the only developed nation that taxes income earned while living abroad. And it only taxes incomes on people who are earning more than $80,000. So the majority of people, I haven't studied the exact proportion of people that are actually paying taxes, but I would suggest that the majority of people are probably not paying taxes. We almost file them if we are Americans living abroad, but you don't pay them unless you're making that amount of money. So in the rest of the world, most countries are offering votes and they don't tax foreign pay. I've listed the countries there that tax expats and do have external voting, and then I've listed other countries which tax expats but don't offer them votes. So I just don't think that there's any evidence that any other country is linking these two. And there's also the issue, that we don't require the exchange of taxes for voting privileges in any other context. We don't exclude net recipients of taxation. And if you look up that phrase, no representation without taxation, in Google, you'll find it really used in two contexts. One is the Irish immigrant vote context, and the other is with, there seems to be some kind of little movement of people who would like to exclude people who are net recipients of taxation from voting in their home countries. So it's a little, I just think that argument is one that has very little validity if you look at the international experience. in talking about the future, I would ask the question whether external voting is inevitable, and I'm going to take a quick look at the Irish and global trends that I think that may be bringing us in that direction. And also talk, there's another aspect of Shannon reform, which I think might have some interesting consequences. I'm not really sure how it will work out, but I just thought I could speculate and see what you guys think. In terms of the changing migration trends, this is the paradox, is that when we have fewer immigrants, I think we'll have a much better chance at gaining voting rights, because it's going to lessen the perceived threat to resident voters, and it will bring us more in line with international rates of immigration. So, and I think that there's a kind of a sadness there in that when people would have probably been more in use of it, and, you know, it could have been better for them, that it wouldn't be possible, really, as much as it would be, you know, in the future. And also, I think we have to acknowledge the fact that the Irish trend is toward a more active engagement with our immigrants. I was at the US-Ireland Forum last month, and the point was made extensively that when you have fewer immigrants, it's actually going to be a lot more important to nurture these relationships. And I think that Ireland, as other countries have found, will start finding that this could be a valuable tool for that. Okay, and then the international trends. Again, we have the global trend of there is a huge trend towards more active engagement between diasporas and home countries. And this is driven by increased globalization and technology. And as our links are improving, the expectations of the relationship are improving, are being raised. And again, we have the issue of the continuing media coverage of external voting from migrants in Ireland, I think is going to further normalize the idea of allowing immigrant voting. So, and then I was going to kind of end it there last night until I started looking at the Shannon reform issue, which I was really interested in the university reform that's being proposed. And again, none of this might happen, so I just want to throw it out there. The report has recommended widening the university constituencies to include all graduates of Irish third-level institutions. So, and currently, as we know, it is only graduates of Trinity or NUI can vote, whether they're resident in Ireland or not. So this would make a fairly large impact in terms of numbers, and that's why they're making the case for it, because it would widen it out. The Shannon report noted that the university, that it's a good thing that the university representation allows for immigrant representation. They actually said, another argument in favor of higher education representation, and one that is often overlooked, is that it provides the means by which people from Northern Ireland and immigrants can participate in Shannon elections. The evidence given during the public hearing suggests that a significant number of voters in the current TCD constituency in particular are resident in Northern Ireland. So the intent then of the report was clearly that to keep the status quo in that immigrant representation was a good thing when it came to university representation. So I'm just wondering what effect this will be. They also say that they would change the registration of university voters to a national graduate register. Currently it's held by the universities. So this would list all eligible graduate voters. So I might be going out on a limb here, but it seems to me this would resolve those four issues that have been highlighted as reasons why you couldn't have immigrant voting, the administrative and logistical roadblocks. The only one it doesn't, so it says, you know, maintaining a register, I forget what they all were now, it's maintaining a register, how you're going to actually run the process. Yeah, exactly. Who would qualify to vote? How would the register be compiled and maintained? How would voting be organized? And if it were by postal ballot, how could the integrity of the electoral process be safeguarded? So to me, it's turning the responsibility back on the reformers to answer those questions. And the only question that... So then you would have a structure. You would have the infrastructure that would allow for widened external voting. So I don't see why this wouldn't provide the infrastructure for general external voting in the future. The only question then would be up for debate would be who can vote. So, but if it's, I would argue as well that if widening university constituencies does nothing else other than allowing more third-level educated immigrants who living abroad to vote, it would do more to just further normalize external voting rights in Ireland, because this would again it just doesn't seem to be a controversial thing that we allow Trinity and NUI graduates to vote from abroad. I don't know why it would be a controversial thing for more third-level university graduates to be voting from abroad. So I just think it's an incremental step, which to me, and I could be crazy, could have profound consequences. But I thought I'd lay that out. So that's it.
Well, I'm sure you'll agree with me that has provided a
major body of evidence. I think that Nori is to be complimented on the manner in which she carried out the research and the detail. In fact, I was priding myself on knowing a great deal about this issue, but I have to say that my knowledge has been considerably improved. So well done, Nori, and I think that it's wonderful, absolutely first class. Yes. The idea is that in the time remaining to us that we would stimulate debate on the three papers that have been presented to us. If I could just briefly just comment on and maybe fill in for your own information this ongoing debate that's been going on two levels, one about immigrant voting and the other about Senate reform. About 10 years ago there was a group of expats who carried out a lobby. Some of you might remember their name, but they were very, very active. And at that time, when the mind of politicians was being turned towards the possibility of immigrant voting, notwithstanding what Noreen has said about the resistance or hostility to it, it was summed up rather eloquently and very politically by Dick Spring at the time, who said that he did not wish to be awaiting the result of the box from Boston to decide the last seat in Kerry North. And this came from a man who lost his seat by 4 votes. And I think what maybe Noreen hasn't touched on here, and I wouldn't have expected to her in the way she's approached it, is that, again, and I'm talking from the inside here, from the political inside, the main problem always was, up to recently, because of the fact that there was a significant amount of involuntary immigration, that the main problem was about the system of voting that we have in this country. Proportional representation, single transferable vote, and all of us have witnessed experiences right across the country where constituencies and the long count has gone on. In fact, the famous MacDougall and Gormley long count in 97 and Ben Briscoe and Eric Byrne in Dublin South Central are two examples of what we're talking about. Cork South Central, Cathy Sinnott and John Dennehy in the 2002 election again went on. Whereas I would suggest that the vast majority of the other countries, certainly in Europe, Europe operates on a list system where, as you know, it is based, that the seat proportionality is based on the voting proportionality. So it doesn't directly affect the actual individual candidates who are putting themselves up. It's a national vote. Britain has a first-past-the-post system. The United States has a first-past-the-post system. I'm only being the devil's advocate here, and I'm only just throwing these things out for the benefit of us that are here. But I'm just saying that that was the main reason. But I think the fact that Noreen has highlighted something we all know is that there has been a serious decline in involuntary immigration that may be coupled with the whole notion of shadow reform, that now might be the time, might be right. Timing is everything in politics, so maybe the timing is right to relook at this. I would also agree with her that in light of what John Gormley has been saying, that it's almost certain, I would say virtually certain, that the franchise will be extended to all university graduates before the next Senate election, irrespective of what other reforms that may come into place. It's been something of a little bit of a mini scandal, because all of us voted as far back as 1979 to extend that in a referendum, and no government of any hue introduced that particular glaring reform since 1979, and still hasn't been introduced. He's only promising it, but I have a feeling that that will happen, because the arguments for it are overwhelming. And the other point that she made about the new Ireland, which the new island and the new priorities, Noreen is absolutely right that evidence would suggest that there has been a significant number of graduates from TCD who traditionally would have come from Northern Ireland, and traditionally of the Unionist persuasion. And in fact, my good friend Shane Ross, we used to rather jokingly refer to Shane, and by the way, he had no problem with it, as the Unionist senator in the House, because Shane cultivated the Northern Unionist vote in the Senate elections with great success. And during periods of great controversy in North-South, East-West relations, whenever there were Senate debates, Shane went out of his way to articulate what he believed to be the Unionist view in order to give a more balance to the debates. So you're absolutely right. There has been an active participation by graduates of TCD from Northern Protestants. Anyway, there are just a few insights to add to what Noreen has said in an absolutely excellent paper, and I'm sure all of you will agree that the three papers that have been presented here have fueled our knowledge and also, I would think, stimulated a debate, and I would like you to perhaps acknowledge them in our traditional manner by a round of applause. So, if there are any questions from the floor, please. If you could give your name, but I understand that this is
Page. Siobhan Gorman from Sandwell. I've been listening today, and I feel that we need to maybe look at what our understanding is of the Irish community, because a couple of times it's been referred to as an ageing population, particularly when we're talking about England. From a personal point of view, I consider myself Irish. I've got an Irish passport. I've got an English accent. I've got an Irish name, but my English accent, people think, well, you know, you're not really Irish. My children have got four Irish grandparents. Three of my four children have got Irish passports. Their dad's Irish. They're considered plastic paddies and plastic biddies within our own community, which can be a little bit upsetting. And it was great to see Dion funding this year recognising and acknowledging cultural activities and heritage activities which could enable and facilitate the younger members of our community to kind of hook onto something with their heritage. And I was very moved with what Karen presented earlier on and with what Philip said, because the people that Karen took on holiday and is planning to take on holiday have all got children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren maybe. A lot of the people that Philip's referring to have got children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren. And for them to know what their their older relatives' experience was, whether it's from living in England or from what Philip has said, going out to war, if we don't, as the older people in the Irish community, some of the older people, but you know that there are some young, there's loads of people in the Irish, but if we as a community don't kind of pass on that richness of our heritage and the experience of our forefathers, is going to be lost. And I sowed the seed of getting an Irish History Month going in the UK. That would be great, because we owe it to our generations, you know, to come, our current younger people and generations to come, to acknowledge what the Irish experience is, what our forefathers have done, and, you know, how they've survived and how they've created what is this country now, rich as it is, and, you know, scattered around the world. So just really to make a plea that we acknowledge and recognise that the Irish community is so much wider than we may be referred to a couple of times this morning as being older ones, because if we don't, we are, in a way, dispossessing and displacing so, so, so many people of Irish heritage and Irish descent.
Thank you very much. Basically, what you're talking about is identity, and maybe Philip, coming as he does from a Northern Protestant background and in the context of post-Good Friday Agreement Ireland, whether he has ever come across this question of identity as he trawls through history, which of course was as much about identity as much of what he was saying. Do you have any response to that?
You know, a word that I'm very fond of using is the word hybrid, or the word hybridity. You know, that very often in the past people thought of national identity as being a pure thing, a very simple and a very pure thing. And perhaps that was needed at a time whenever national identity had to be asserted over against empires and so on. But nowadays we can see it as being a very mixed thing. And what I find positive about the story of these soldiers is quite clearly there's a hybrid thing there. They're fighting for Britain, but they're also deeply, deeply Irish. And I think one of the positive things that has come out of the Good Friday Agreement has been that wonderful phrase that says that any person who's a citizen in the North has the right to consider themselves Irish or British or indeed both
or by implication, I think, something else as well. You know, that there is the possibility of juggling your identities, that all our identities are a mix of different things anyway, both what we inherit, you know, almost, if you like, genetically, what we inherit culturally and so on. And the North is a... Professor Edna Longley has used this wonderful phrase about the North, for example, a corridor of identities. Love that idea of a corridor. It's not something constricting. It's something you can move up and down. So, you know, I can cherish my Irish aspects deeply, but I'm also very fond of certain aspects of my Britishness as well. And other stuff as well that comes into play, you know. My Europeanness, my global citizenship, so on and so forth. So those are the thoughts that come to my mind when you're talking.
Anybody else on that particular subject? Seamus.
Chairman, we listened to three very interesting speakers. I can empathise with everything Patsy McGarry said, because Ballyhadrin is our hometown. I was fascinated by what Philip Orr said, and I'm just coming back to tell a brief story on that, which is one that I haven't told before in public. And I was fascinated listening to Noreen's exposition on voting rights for immigrants or Irish abroad or whatever, and I've been listening to the debate on that for the last 40 years, so I won't say anything right now. But the brief story, when I was living in Brussels, one night, as it happened, I was in an Irish pub with three others, and I was a member of the Irish club. And in that pub, on that particular night in 1984, 70 years after he arrived in Belgium, an Irish man was brought into the pub by his grandson through something that had been triggered off in his life. He was then 92 years of age. He had left County Down. He was a Catholic. He married a Protestant, and he joined the British Army. And he remained in Belgium for the whole of his life up to that point. Had never gone home for a whole range of reasons, which eventually he was to tell us when we met him at the Irish club and feted him. And he was had never had any contact with Irish people in the meantime, had deliberately shunned them. And now in his old age, here he was coming back. So we sort of integrated him in the Irish club. He listened to some Irish music, saw some Irish dancing, began to talk as people of that age are wont to do, going back to their childhood. But there's just one instance of an Irish person, a person in County Down, left when we were still under British rule, and had cut himself off, as it were, for, as I said, a whole range of reasons. That's just one person, and I will always remember that, because it was fascinating when we introduced him to the members of the Irish club and brought him along to a couple of socials. I think he died 3 years later at the age of 95, after I had returned to Dublin. Thank you.
Sheila Gleason, Coalition of Irish Immigration Centres. I think the issue of identity is kind of a one that's near and dear to everybody, every immigrant. You know, when I was flying over here, the guy beside me in the plane said, "Are you going home or are you visiting?" And I was kind of stumped by the question. You know, I was like, "Well, I'm going home, but I'll be going home to Boston on Monday." You know, so it's this kind of pull. Where is home? And I feel very much that I'm coming home here, in spite of all the changes, and there have been significant. But the issue arises now. My kids are Irish American. But I would hate them to lose that piece of their identity. I don't even really, you know, like the idea of them being called Irish American. It's kind of, it's distancing. And so, I mean, there's all this talk about the diaspora. And I guess my interest in that would be how we can look at, whether it's through voting rights or a whole range of other things, how we can kind of bring that global family together. It's an important thing. And I think that in the context of, you know, bringing people back to Ireland, people are less likely to leave for the reasons that I did. We were sort of, you know, unemployment was 20% or close to it when we left Ireland in the early 80s. And, you know, so there wasn't really an opportunity to come back. But nowadays there is that opportunity of, you know, movement. And the more you can keep that connection, the more you can facilitate that movement where people will feel more part of it. And, you know, I'd love to think maybe my kids could come back and be part of it here as well. So I think it's a really important and critical kind of issue in terms of identity in the broader context. And, you know, I great presentations by everybody here today. It was really, really great. Thank you.
Just a very brief comment. I'm Gráinne Pryor from the Irish Commission for Prisoners Overseas. And Patsy, you finished your speech by giving a tribute to the church and the work they had done. But I'd just like to say, really, just thinking of, and you spoke earlier about the media and the role in pricking conscience, but listening to Philip Orr's presentation on Irish soldiers abroad, and really there has been such a mind change in the last even 5 years, 10 years certainly in this country, and I really think so much of that is due to the media, and to your own work, no doubt, and a colleague of yours, Patsy, I think, Kevin Myers, or a former colleague, who has really done Trojan work there. So I think just to use that then, perhaps linking it into what we were talking about this morning, Brian Harvey was talking about the Good Body Report, and again, the need for, you know, policy and, you know, partnerships and all the rest. But I suppose in a way that's very much where groups like ourselves here with, I think, very sympathetic media. And it's not to say that media it can be both sympathetic and rigorous, can really, you know, drive change and help implement really, you know, very good things for all, you know, like we've seen, as I said, the example of soldiers, but equally what Sheila is talking about, all this wider debate of identity and forward planning and, you know, retrospection, all these things. So, and just to compliment all the speakers, both this afternoon and this morning, obviously.
And I'm wondering how many of you feel about this. Is there a perception growing that because the changes that have taken place in Ireland, that really this current generation, and maybe our own generation, don't care as much about what the Irish, that in other words, because emigration, involuntary emigration has effectively finished, we are now focused on immigration, and that really there's no issue out there anymore. And if there is no issue out there anymore, that the underlying problem is, as was raised at the US-Ireland Forum, was because of the changing nature of the relationship between the mother country and the diaspora, there is a real danger going forward that we could lose all that influence that we have been so proud of over the decades, going way back to the last century and beyond. And I'm wondering whether does the media only respond whenever there's an issue like the undocumented, as distinct from the deeper issues?
But being media, I suppose we do tend to react an awful lot more than we do initiate. I have to say that probably the immigration issue has become somewhat overwhelmed by the immigration issue in latter years particularly, except for the undocumented matter in the United States, which has been very much in the forefront of the portage for the past number of years. But I don't think there's a lack of interest at all in the experience of Irish immigrants abroad. I think that it tends to dip, as issues do. There are moments of sustained interest, and then it moves on to something else, and on to something else, and then probably back again. And I think that tends to be a pattern with just about every issue that is addressed through media or by media. My only concern really is that as less and less Irish people do emigrate abroad, that our younger generation will lose awareness of this issue and of what's involved, and of the experience of the older generations, older Irish generations abroad, and of current older Irish people living abroad as well. And I think that we need to work on that to sustain the relationships to next Sheila's case, to their generation, and to sustain those ties as well. But on the other hand, I mean, ties have been renewed with South American Irish communities that were practically forgotten about for generations, in Argentina particularly. There's been this total revival of that. I mean, most of us, including myself, wasn't even aware of that community until comparatively recently, well, recent decades anyhow. Yeah, I might go back to what Philip had to say earlier on. I found it absolutely fascinating, and it's a bit of a hobby horse of my own, because I've been covering Drumcree for the last 8 to 9 years for my sins every year. But it's an issue that interests me both in context of my own area of responsibility for the newspaper. But it's about the song, essentially.
but it's the first Sunday in July when in the, those parishes, something like 300 young men were killed by the machine gun that Philip referred to. Two of them were from Drumcree Parish itself, and it gives the whole Drumcree issue a hugely broader emotive element than just walking down the Garvahy Road, which is also linked then to identity, of course, as well. But what, last year being the 50th anniversary, 60th anniversary, I decided to look at my own parish at home, as, I mean, everything is local, not just politics, and where the Somme was concerned and the First World War was concerned, and I was fascinated and very saddened to what I discovered, that through a book by Father Liam Soares, who's a priest who's researching the Diocese of O'Connery, and his latest book details the men who died from the parishes of O'Connery in the various world wars, including the Great War. And I found that 37 men from our parish were killed in World War I. I never knew this. I had no awareness that of any of them, or that anybody had died. What the person I talked to really was the focus for the interview, which was published in the paper on the 1st of July last year, was Madame Felicity McDermott. She's married into, originally from the home counties of Fife in England. She married in 1953 into the McDermott family, who are probably one of the oldest Irish Catholic families. Her brother-in-law, and this is how close it still is, Hugh McDermott, was killed at Gallipoli in 1915, Lieutenant Hugh McDermott. He is the only one of the men who died in World War I in my parish to be commemorated by a plaque, which is in Monastraden Church, where Father Vincent Sherlock said a mass there, Sister Tractor I was talking to earlier on about, in 2005 to commemorate the 50th anniversary of his death. But what I couldn't help thinking about is the families of the 37 men who died, 314 in all of County Roscommon, in fact, had to bury that fact. They'd lost. Hugh McDermott's body was never found, for instance. That would probably have been the case for the vast majority of the 37 in the parish. There were no funerals. They couldn't talk about it. They had to bury it. It was a factor of shame in the New Ireland after 1916, and particularly after 1918, that they had a son who not only fought in the British Army, but died fighting with the British Army. So those poor people had to erase that memory entirely, and probably their descendants. And now, I suppose, thankfully, in part due to the work of Kevin Myers and other people, we've come to a context where we can write these things and talk about these things.
I think what also has to be said to Patsy is that, I mean, we've got to recognise that back in the 1920s and 30s, it was a very, very difficult issue for the new government in the Irish Free State. I mean, what used to happen in the 1920s, quite clearly, was that the unionist population who still existed and were quite strong here, especially in the east of Ireland, used to come out onto the streets by 50,000, 60,000, wave Union Jacks, wear poppies and so on. And there was a real fear that this would destabilise the new state. The commemoration of the war looked like resurgence of the thing up at Empire. And one of the, I think, the very subtle and very positive things that De Valera did in the 1930s when he first came to power was say, yes, you can still have commemoration of the First World War and commemoration and so on, but you must only you mustn't do marching, and you mustn't wave Union Jacks. You can wear your poppy, but you know, do it. And when you're walking along the street, walk to the cenotaph. Don't march. Try to demilitarize it and de-British it, if you like. And I think De Valera requires some kind of praise for that, because I think he acted very subtly back in the 1930s in what was a difficult situation. But can I also say one of the things that I've learned about the war experience is the importance of oral history, and I think this applies to the Irish diaspora. You know, there is so much wonderful stuff to be done to preserve all that memory through oral history. With people getting out there with recording equipment, and again, it's a media thing as well, isn't it? You know, and storing those stories in an archive, especially for that particular diverse, fascinating story that spans the world. And that's the only way that's going to be preserved, because if it's only a matter of passing it down to your grandson, you know, it'll soon be forgotten if it's done informally. So, and I think there's a huge need for an Irish archive of maybe that's already happening, I don't know, is it?
I don't think so.
There's a need for a museum of emigration, an emigration museum in this country, where such things can be pulled together. And we must be the only major migrant nation that doesn't have one. And there seems to be no interest in acquiring one. And we're about to demolish the Carlisle Pier in Dunleary to be replaced by a multi-purpose glamorous Celtic Ireland block, which will have retail units, residential units, and a, quotation marks, cultural centre, and that was the specifications for the design. The designs that were shortlisted were put on display for public vetting, if you like, a couple of years ago. And the design that won public approbation, shall we say, by a mile, was won by Daniel Libeskind, the New York Jewish architect, who is a child of immigrants. And he specified as the cultural element a diaspora museum, a museum of immigration. And overwhelmingly, people who visited the display voted for that design. That design was rejected. I don't have an explanation for it, but you can be guaranteed that when the Carlisle Pier is demolished, there won't be so much as a plaque to the thousands who left this country on the wretched boat. And as Pascal talked about last night in his programme, the Princess Maud, I was on it myself. I think it's a national disgrace, but it brings up for me an issue that is like the elephant in the room. Nobody wants to talk about it. The unit for the Irish abroad, an agency for the Irish abroad, the government should do this, the government should do that. The people who benefited from the remittances of immigrants should do it, not the government. And that's what I don't see happening. That's what's conspicuously lacking, is action on the ground at parish level, a reaching out, as I was saying earlier, from the contemporaries of the ones who left, by the ones who stayed. And when you talk about recognising the issues of identity and acknowledging the war dead, you know, all these ghosts, we're very like the Americans here in that we have got rich and we want to move forward and we want to draw a veil over the past. One of the World War poets had a poem about the many thousands of homes where there were no men after the war, and there would be old ladies who were sweethearts, who were sisters, who were wives, living alone, and there were two lines in it, and in slow dusks a drawing down of blinds. Well, in this country we've been drawing down the blinds for a very long time about a lot of issues we don't want to confront. We don't want to confront the fact that we were predominantly, in many cases, ashamed of the Irish in Britain, but we glorified the Irish in America because the Irish in America succeeded. We felt that too many of the Irish in Britain had to go because our magistrates, when a young lad got into trouble, would say he can go to jail or he could go to England. I know a man who got an MBE for his services as a director of tarmac construction, became a director of it, whose mother wouldn't let him write home to Limerick, even though he was a working tradesman in London, from a London postmark stamp letter, because she was ashamed that the neighbours might think he'd had to go for those reasons. You know, we're too inclined to not to force a confrontation and a recognition and an acknowledgement, as I say, at grassroots level, at parish level. You know, I think that's a major weakness.
Way behind time, and I'm getting secrets from the back. There is one other young man that wanted to ask something.
Thank you, Bjorn. I appreciate that. Very struck listening to Philip, your description of some of the soldiers who came back. You said they lay low, they didn't talk about it. Then you describe them effectively suffering in silence. It would seem that's kind of an Irish male response to a lot of things that we could say for soldiers, and what we've talked about maybe for immigrants, and maybe going home alone is kind of a thing we do, and going to the pub can be going home alone too. There is another piece of isolation that we're increasingly seeing. We've been aware of rural isolation, single men. Changes in drink driving laws, which are necessary, have an unintended and unwanted consequence. But we're also seeing that in urban Ireland. I was at a meeting last night, and a guy talked about an organisation that they're setting up, Men Living Alone in No Man's Land, which is pre-echoes of what you were talking about today. But Men Living Alone in No Man's Land, he described as that group of people, they are Sky Sports and cheap booze from the supermarket. He says, if you do not catch them when they're still going out to the pub, you will never see them again, because they go back to, in Dublin, they go back to the flat complexes, etc. They live alone, drink themselves probably to death. So what we're actually seeing there is patterns, and Patsy, you talked about the Polish community drinking at home. We're actually doing the same now. So it's almost as if some people in Ireland, including native Irish people, are behaving like emigrants in their own country. There is a stunning growth in isolation, rural and urban Ireland. The urban piece has not been commented on much yet, but Skye,
24-hour sport and television, and I'm not blaming them, that's a wonderful thing, but it facilitates something. Okay, it probably isn't, but we'll say it anyway. That and cheap booze. Booze is an old Irish problem. The other piece I just wanted to throw into this, nobody used the term the fighting Irish, but that's, if men going home alone and men suffering in silence is an Irish problem, there's a piece in there that somehow, as we never helped soldiers to get over what they went through, and we still wouldn't know how to do that, it's very much part of an image, and this is not unique to Ireland, but it is part of the image of the Irish. Now, whether it's a soldier going abroad or kids learning to fight in a schoolyard, and then a growth in gangs, and an image, and what is it that we're doing? Again, not unique to Ireland, but there is a little bit extra piece in there that male attitudes and expectations of men in Ireland seem to kick in all of these issues, and not just to affect soldiers, and not just to affect immigrants. I say this part because I'm working on a community project that's looking at male issues at the moment. I just think there's another set of themes going around in there somewhere.
Yeah, I am the elephant in the room, because I'm not supposed to be here today, because I'm only here to do the recording. But I just want to make two contributions, maybe a third very short one. The world is getting a very small place, and today has been podcast, so it can be heard in offices and centres around the world. But like broadband, it has issues getting to the last mile. So the immigrants you might want to reach won't have the iPod, the MP3 player, the computer, the broadband. But don't let that stop you, because through local communities and centres and schools, people can record what is available on the internet and drop the CD into the person's home, where they can play it on their CD player or their DVD player on the TV. Very briefly, Philip, wonderful, wonderful talk. I think we have captured some wonderful oral history today. Thank you very much. It means a lot to me. My own grandfather fought in the Somme out of a Belfast regiment, Drogheda man, and while he didn't fight with Ledwich, he was his first cousin. They were over, I think, at the same time. To Patsy, once again, wonderful talk. I do want to maybe announce that I run a campaign called RTE2FDA.com, number two, to get RTE available on screens in Ireland and in the UK. Pascal's out there on the radio, and it's, you know, wonderful to hear requests coming in from all over the British Isles. And RTE television broadcasts to the same footprint as the radio, but sadly it's encrypted. And that's for programme rights issues. Now, in March, the Dáil mandated RTE to broadcast RTE International Service. And I just wonder, has the panel any views to what that service might be and how far-reaching it should go?
What I'd like to do before we do that is, Paula Lally is here to make a contribution on emigration of people at risk. And at the risk of delaying people with trains and everything else and other commitments, perhaps we could ask Paula if she would make a contribution. And thank you for your patience, and we will ask our contributors to just do a brief wrap-up. Paula, can I just say what you're doing? That Paula is an information worker with Crosscare Migrant Project, which is the advice in 2005, specialising in immigration and return migration. She wrote books going to the USA, going to the UK, going to Australia, going to Canada, each was subtitled The Practical Guide for Immigration, all published in recent weeks. So, Paula Lally.
Thanks very much, Pascal. That's actually not my introduction. I don't have to do it. As Pascal said, earlier this week we launched four pre-departure information books, a copy of which I have here, for people thinking of emigrating, going to the USA, going to Australia, going to Canada, and going to the UK. When we decided to develop the Going to USA, Going to Canada, and Going to Australia books, we consulted with Irish organisations in these countries to utilise their knowledge and skills as frontline organisations dealing with newly arrived. Through this consultation process, we developed practical and comprehensive guides to emigrating. The books have chapters containing information on all aspects a person will need to know and consider before they emigrate. For example, temporary visas, permanent visas, finding accommodation, finding a job, and Irish contacts. We were delighted to have the Jeannie Johnson as our venue for the launch event to remind people that while migration trends have changed dramatically in recent years, emigration is still happening. And our guest speaker at the event was Father Peter McFerry, and he stated that emigration has never gone away. The CSO figures show that approximately 17,000 people still emigrate each year. Most thrive in their newly adopted country, but there are still a small number of Irish people on the margins of society, disillusioned with their prospects here in Ireland, who are continuing to emigrate to the UK in situations of crisis. Following the research we commissioned Patricia Walls to carry out called Still Leaving, our main focus has been and continues to be people with high support needs, people leaving in crisis situations. This includes people with addiction problems, people with mental health problems, people who have just left prison, people who use homeless services here in Ireland, and people who just want to change from their difficult life here in Ireland. Some of these people end up going on the spur of the moment with little or no planning and support. 4,000 Irish people emigrate to the UK per year, and approximately 400 of these end up in crisis situations. Since 2005, we have been liaising with Irish organisations in the UK, specifically the Passage Day Centre in London, Camden Irish Centre, Merseyside Irish Community Care in Liverpool, the Irish Welfare and Information Centre in Birmingham, and Manchester Irish Community Care, collating data on newly arrived Irish people in crisis situations to influence our work here in Ireland. On a monthly basis, we get feedback from these organisations on the number of new arrivals, their age and profile, so we can plan our work here to try and reach these groups before they go. When we were developing the new Going to UK book, we consulted with these Irish organisations in the UK to ask their expert opinion on what we needed to target people intending on going to the UK without proper preparation and planning, and to ensure that people are not leaving ill-prepared. The UK book, along with our one-to-one walk-in service and our outreach service, aims to give the required support and information they need, and we will be further developing our outreach services throughout the Dublin Diocese during 2008. The UK book contains detailed information on the various topics, from what payments you can transfer from Ireland to the UK, information on benefits and entitlements in the UK, and as I'll just let you have a look at the rest of them there. It also contains very practical information on finding accommodation and the cost of accommodation in some of the major cities in the UK, like London, Liverpool, Manchester and Birmingham. Finally, the distribution of all these books will take place before Christmas, and it has been informed by the consultation process we carried out with Irish organisations abroad and our 20 years' experience of working with intending emigrants. Thank you.
And can I say that we've been aware, nearly all, everybody here has been aware of the ongoing work that has been done in relation to providing information. I have to tell you as well that, Paula, I will be making a phone call to you in the next few weeks for you to come and talk to us on the new programme about this. So it'll be one of the many. That's why I was saying there was a certain selfish motive about my highlighting the fact we were doing the programme. Could I ask very briefly, and I'm aware that Father Alan is having canaries, could I very briefly ask our three contributors if they would just do a very brief wrap-up in the context of anything that wasn't dealt with or some of the issues that arose that they didn't get a chance or may wish to, just if they could have 1 minute each, perhaps. Starting with Patsy.
Well, just to answer Brian, I'd like to support what you're trying to do, Brian, in facilitating the availability of RTE to as wide a population of Irish people abroad as possible. As I said earlier, I also think that it would be very helpful, particularly for older Irish immigrants abroad, but not just them, for younger Irish people too, if they could have access to the local radio stations. I don't know how that's technologically feasible or not. You'd probably have the answers to that. And as to allude to what I said earlier on, I think there's an important that we keep the issue alive, the issue of immigrants abroad alive, not just for the elderly people who are away at the moment, but I think that in a broader context, we have discovered a lot of newer members of the Irish family abroad in recent decades, and I think it's to all of our benefits, to theirs in terms of identity as well, and our own in terms of identity, that we keep that, those connections and those relationships alive.
Thank you, Patsy. Philip?
What I'd like to say is in response to the gentleman here who was lamenting the absence of a museum of the Irish diaspora, all I can say to him and to other people is, look at what we now have in Collins Barracks. In the museum there, we have a fantastic display giving the history of Irish military involvement right down through the centuries in a way that would never have been seen before. So perhaps there is, if groups like yourselves push for it and press for it, the likelihood of a museum with Irish diaspora here. But can I make a final plea that that might be something that would be well worth doing in a cross-border context? Because, as I said, families like my own in the north experienced a similar thing, and it might be a way of bonding together a little more the two parts of the island on that enterprise.
And if I'm right, visited by the First Minister of Paisley when he came down to Dublin,
yes,
as far as I remember. So, yeah. Noreen?
I really have nothing to add out of this session. I just want to thank everyone for your contributions. I just think it's been a great day, and I really appreciate from the speakers as well, everyone on the floor. I was just really impressed by the level of enthusiasm and commitment and everything from what people were saying, so thanks.
Thank you very much. Father Allen?
Thanks on behalf of everybody. Even though it looks like we're running out of time, we're not actually, because the AGM only takes about 10 minutes. It's just, as a publicly funded organisation, we have to extend the invitation to the public to be present when you present the accounts and also elect members. So that's the reason. So it'll be very quick. So when this is over, finish the vote of thanks, we'll give people about 5 minutes because some will want to go, and then we'll call everyone to order and have the AGM, which will take approximately 5 to 10 minutes.
Okay.
So just on behalf of AIM, I want to propose a vote of thanks to Brian Harvey this morning for his wonderful, insightful presentation, which I think will help advance what the Goodbody Report is trying to do. I mean, we're all trying to learn and move on, and I think it gave excellent insights. And there's a few things resonating with what he said. To thank Seamus for moderating so well this morning and his continued support. I think it's interesting to note that what Noreen is proposing, the curriculum this morning, has been taken on by people from England, that they would like to take that curriculum back to the UK. That's something we never envisaged happening from today, so thank you for that. For Karen and her input on the holiday pilot programme, we believed in our hearts that this should happen, and we've worked hard to try and make it happen. And I think with great experience of people like Mary, who's done this in the past, I think people in their last years have never had the chance to come home, deserve the chance to come back. They've made their home in England, we know that, but just to touch base and walk the old lanes and just see, not only made the flight, they want to come on the boat because they want to see, well, as long as they can, the harbour in Dunleary. but they want to remember the place they left. That's very important. And that journey was tremendous. It's filled with human beings, and their story is excellent. I want to thank Pascal for joining us this afternoon, and he is accepting a nomination for the board, and I think that's a great help to the board, so thank you for that. Patsy, you know, the one thing about the Irish Times I admire about the Irish Times is that most of us who work in the media world realise you have to write the stories for journalists. You give the press release and most of it's published, but the Irish Times listens. Patsy listens. I mean, Patsy could have not come this morning. He did. He's listening, he's sounding out, and that will get reflected, I know, maybe next Christmas. I don't know, it'll get reflected sometime in the Irish Times, a column attributed to today, but your listening is more than we can ask for, so thank you for that, Patsy, and your input as well, which I think goes to show in civil society we need the media, even though most of us have reasons to be anxious about it at times, but we need it. It's part of the process, so thank you, Patsy, for that. Philip, you know, I was privileged, well, the greatest privilege of my life would be the fact that I was the first to lead the service for Anzac Day here in the Republic that we had 2 years ago, started by the new Australian ambassador. You know, I think in the past, sometimes when you went to Anzac Day memorials or commemorative memorials here in Ireland, you felt you had to go to absolution afterwards. There was a strange thinking here in the state about it. But my own uncle left, my grandmother died when she was 9, my uncle left at 15 on the boat, a young boy on his own, and joined the Marines, and he's very terminally ill at the moment in the UK. So it brings out what Philip was saying, that some sociologist said, we ask for workers, we get people. This whole thing is about people. And like in all the talks, that's what it's about. And I think if there's any reason for AIM and other bodies to be around is to remind the world, the globalised world, that migration is about people. And I want to thank Noreen for her excellent presentation on political representation, which was done in a very non-threatening way. I don't think any government minister or department would get worried about it. It was, you know, the whole issue is global, and she took us there. And it's looking at it in a way, in a healthy way, and a way of inevitability that it has to come about. The form and the shape of it is for another day's work. I want to thank Paula for her work, and her, I know she's been at deadlines the last while to get these books out, and she's done a great job and has really researched people on the ground. And congratulations on the publications and the continued good work. And congratulate Yvonne, who got married 4 weeks ago. I just want to say, I think today was a privileged day, and one of the great privileges was seeing Noreen, who was only with us for over a year, just, you know, really come into her own today in terms of putting the day together and our presentations. And I think Aine is in safe hands with Noreen around, and we're very proud of all her achievements. And I suppose I should have a bouquet of flowers or something, but I will in some way repay, you know, acknowledge the wonderful work you did today in bringing all these people on board. I would just say, I'm not putting pressure on anyone, but I would say to Philip, you know, particularly that one of the issues we have been looking at in AIM is involved in the Northern Dimension in a real wholesome way. So if you have any offer of advice for us, or any way we can go about it, we would warmly embrace it, because it's very much part of what we do. And I know particularly the people who suffered a lot in America, the undocumented, and the people who had to get out because they didn't want to take up arms on either side. And I met them in Australia as well. They wanted to get away from paramilitarism, and the opportunity was emigration. And now they're locked, you know, in America. They can't move one way or the other. And that has to be looked at. So thank you, particularly, you know, as we extend the frontiers. I finished in my job at the Bishops' Conference yesterday, which means I'm stepping down for a while. I got the good fortune, after an argument with the Archbishop, to get a sabbatical. So I'm going off to do a bit of study and a bit of reflection for the year. I will be taking a little distance from AIM. And from emigrant affairs, but I won't be removed, because I don't want to leave a gap in such a way that whoever replaces me in a few weeks will feel that they won't take on AIM and all the rest. So I'm leaving that open. So it's been an absolute privilege and a joy. And I know today's meeting, I know all the people who will be listening to it outside this room, and it's very important that this is happening, because we can't ask them every time, which is ridiculous when you talk about value for money, every time there's a meeting here in Ireland to get on a plane to come home. You know, they're out there working on the ground, doing what they do, but we have to cultivate the arguments here and engage them and involve them. That's what we're using modern technology to do that. So I think that's a wonderful attribute, and it's one of Noreen's skills to be able to do that, because I haven't a clue. I don't know how to use all me. I give my mobile to my nephew when I want something changed on it. So look, it's part of, we're beyond the room, you know. So I just want to propose a vote of thanks to everybody who took part in today, and particularly a vote of thanks to Noreen as our director, and say we have the trust and confidence of the board moving forward and trying to harness these ideas and bring them into public expression into the future. And I thank Jim Carroll for spending the day with us in the Department of Foreign Affairs, who will be called into the office on Monday and say, what were they saying? What were they giving out? And he'll go through his little notebook and say, really, you were. So Jim, thank you for being here and for all the good work. And we are partners in this thing of remembering that immigration is about human beings that have specific needs that need to be remembered, and those that need the care, that could be speedily extended to in this time. So thank you one and all. We'll take the 5 minute break, the susbiog, and then when I sit down in that chair, we're ready for business. How's that?
Could I just very briefly, before you do what we're all going to do, could I just say that I think that the work of Ian over the last number of years has been considerably enhanced by the presence of Father Alan Hilliard, and I know in my own dealings with him down through the years on the political side and on the various seminars and conferences that we attended, and I know many of you did as well, that he has brought a freshness and enthusiasm and commitment to Ian that I think will be missed, despite the fact that he says he'll be operating at an arm's length. So all we hope is you won't be gone for too long and be back among us. But well done, Father. Well done.
Yeah.
5 minutes.
Cup of tea outside.
Yeah, 5 minutes. Tea outside.